plant managers from planting new areas for bees as water becomes less readily available. Climate change could also increase the spread of varroa and other pathogens. Warmer fall and winter temperatures extend the period when bees forage. Varroa travel on foraging bees. No longer foraging provides a larger time window for mites and the viruses they carry to spread among colonies. Higher mite populations on bee colonies heading into winter will likely cripple colony health and increase winter losses. Studies have already shown that climate change is disrupting seasonal connections between bees and flowers. As spring arrives earlier in the year, flowers bloom earlier or in different regions, but bees may not be present to feed on them. Even if flowers bloom at their usual times and locations, they may produce less nutritious pollen and nectar under extreme weather conditions. Research that analyzes the nutritional profits of bee forage plants and how they change under different climate scenarios will help land managers plant climate-resilient plants for different regions. There are many ways to support bees and pollinators. Planting pollinator gardens with regional plants that bloom throughout the year can provide much-needed forage. Ground-nesting native bees need patches of exposed and undisturbed soil free of mulch or other ground covers. Gardeners can clear some ground in a sunny, well-drained area to create dedicated spaces for bees to dig nests. Another important step is using integrated pest management, a land management approach that minimizes the use of chemical pesticides. And anyone who wants to help monitor native bees can join community science projects and use phone apps to submit data. Most importantly, educating people and communities around the world about bees and their importance to our food system can help create a more pollinator-friendly world.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Secretary General of Iran's High Council for Human Rights, Kazem Gharibabadi, has slammed the French government's crackdown on protesters, saying Paris is violently silencing the voice of dissent.
France's heavy-handed crackdown on peaceful protesters proved the extent of its disregard for human rights. The French government violently silences the voice of dissent. Double standards vis-à-vis human rights have taken a new turn, or what?
Widespread protests erupted in Paris in the wake of a deadly shooting by a gunman at a Kurdish cultural center and nearby cafe on Friday in a busy part of Paris's 10th district.
If it's possible to enter a cultural center with a gun during the day, it means that there is not enough security. It's the kind of thing you only see in France. In other countries, it's not like that. There is no security.
Police arrested a 69-year-old suspect who the French authorities said had recently been freed from detention while awaiting trial for a saber attack on a migrant camp in the capital a year earlier. The attacker killed three people and injured three others. The suspect confessed to a pathological hatred for foreigners and spent nearly a day in a psychiatric facility before being returned to police custody on Sunday. Judicial officials in France have charged the man with murder and attempted murder because of race, ethnicity, nationality, or religion, as well as for the unauthorized procurement and possession of a weapon. The killings also drew Kurdish groups and their supporters onto the streets of Paris. Brimming with fury, the protesters, holding flags and chanting slogans, became disruptive at one point, broke the street railings, and set bins on fire, which led to clashes with police forces after they used tear gas and water cannons to scatter the indignant demonstrators. Police said there had been 11 arrests. Local media reports as well as witnesses said the French police spared no effort to quash the protests as they resorted to excessive use of force in what was literally construed as a heavy-handed crackdown on dissent. In reaction to the French police crackdown on demonstrators, Iran has urged the French government to respect the rights of protesters. In a statement, Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani urged the French law enforcement forces to exercise self-restraint while dealing with peaceful protesters. Kanani said the French government has a track record of dealing with protesters violently and a background of adopting discriminatory policies toward minorities and migrants. Between November 2018 and January 2019, at least 12 people died during the French security forces' crackdown on the Yellow Vest protests against the living and economic conditions across the European country. Friday's shooting drew Kurdish groups and their supporters onto the streets of the French capital, with some of the protesters waving flags of the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK, which is viewed as a terrorist organization by Turkey and its Western allies. Other protesters chanted anti-Turkey slogans and held banners with mottos accusing Ankara of being a killer state and connected to the shooting.
We're obviously targeted by Turkey, by Erdogan's regime, as was the case on January 9, 2013, during the triple murder of Kurdish activists. So today, there is a second time, a repetition of history. Three people again were killed on the eve of the 10th anniversary, and so we reiterate again that for us, there is no doubt that these are political assassinations orchestrated by Turkey.
The French ambassador was summoned after Ankara said French officials did little to stop the anti-Turkey propaganda promoted by the outlawed PKK militants in Paris. The ministry accused the PKK of spreading false information about Ankara's involvement in the shooting. It said the French government and some of its politicians are being used as a tool in this campaign. The ministry urged French authorities to properly look into the violent crimes committed by the terrorist organization. Over the past years, Turkey's relations with France have been stained by their opposing stances on the war in Syria and a range of other disputes. The PKK militants, designated as terrorists by Turkey, the United States, and European Union, regularly clash with Turkish forces in the Kurdish-dominated southeast of the country, which is attached to northern Iraq. A shaky ceasefire between the PKK and the Turkish government collapsed in July 2015. Attacks on Turkish security forces have soared ever since. More than 40,000 people have been killed during the three-decade conflict between Turkey and the autonomy-seeking militant group. Thousands of Moroccans have staged demonstrations across the North African country to reiterate their unwavering support for the Palestinian cause and voice outrage at the U.S.-sponsored normalization of diplomatic relations with Israel on its second anniversary. People from all strata of society heeded a call by the Moroccan Front in support of Palestine and against normalization, took part in nationwide rallies in almost 30 cities to show solidarity with Palestinians and censure Rabat's normalization of ties with the Tel Aviv regime. Protesters converged outside the Parliament of Morocco premises in the capital Rabat, where they chanted slogans in condemnation of the normalization and demanded the reversal of the agreement. The demonstrators waved national Palestinian flags and held up placards that read, "Normalization is treacherous and the struggle will carry on until the normalization is revoked" in Arabic. The participants also set fire to the Israeli flag in front of the legislature's building. The people of Morocco have repeatedly expressed their opposition to the agreement by holding demonstrations and protests. The Moroccan Front in support of Palestine and against normalization said normalization with the regime is passionately opposed by the whole country. On December 2020, Israel and Morocco announced the resumption of diplomatic relations after their suspension in 2000 following the outbreak of the Second Palestinian Intifada. The two agreed to normalize relations by signing a deal brokered by the U.S., making the North African country the fourth Arab state to strike such a deal with the regime. The others were the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Sudan. As part of the accord, Washington agreed to recognize Morocco's sovereignty over the Western Sahara region, which has been at the center of a dispute with neighboring Algeria. Algiers had condemned the U.S. decision, saying it had no legal effect because it contradicts U.N. resolutions, especially U.N. Security Council resolutions on Western Sahara. Morocco and Algeria have long been at odds over the disputed territory of Western Sahara, while Algiers-backed Polisario Front is seeking independence from Rabat's rule. Algeria cut diplomatic ties with Morocco in August 2021, citing hostile acts. Rabat controls over 80% of the territory and is pushing for autonomy under its sovereignty. The Polisario Front, however, wants a UN-sponsored referendum on self-determination. Morocco, like any other Arab country that has recognized Israel, insists it will still work for a two-state solution, but this time by engaging with Israel rather than boycotting it. Morocco clearly decided that developing its economic ties with Israel and winning U.S. recognition of its sovereignty in Western Sahara were too important to pass up. According to an opinion poll conducted by the Arab Barometer, 59% of Moroccans say they are hostile to normalization between Rabat and Tel Aviv. This shows a marked discrepancy between official authorities and Moroccan public opinion. The chasm was further exposed by the rise of several political parties that have accused the Moroccan state of betraying the Palestinian cause and collaborating with Israeli settlers. For example, the Justice and Development Party called for the closure of the Israeli liaison office during the bombing of Gaza last year. The Unified Socialist Party and the Socialist Democratic Vanguard Party showed their opposition to the rapprochement with Israel as well. They called it an illegitimate agreement. With all the opposition and outrage over inking the normalization agreement with Israel, why should Rabat do this? While the normalization was enacted in December 2020, bilateral relations between Morocco and Israel had never fully ceased in the past. In fact, in 2014, hundreds of diplomatic letters leaked by a Moroccan activist revealed that the two had been maintaining an ongoing political dialogue. Similarly, Israeli records reported $37 million in trade with Morocco in 2017, as well as signing of several trade and economic agreements. The diplomatic normalization was simply an opportunity for the kingdom to recognize and strengthen a cooperation that has always existed.
This Christmas is not a time for cheers and festivities for many in the U.S. A hunger crisis is affecting U.S. households. Food insecurity is already a critical problem affecting millions of Americans. One of the most typical factors affecting people suffering from food insecurity this time of the year are extreme winter conditions. But this year especially, many are suffering from hunger and high food prices due to unprecedented inflation that has gripped the U.S.
The gas, the food, everything, milk, egg, everything is it's high now.
It is concerning, so I always shop online to make sure that I can find the best prices for groceries and for, like, gas as well.
Last year, more than 33 million Americans lived in food-insecure households, including 9 million children. The figure dropped in 2021 thanks to COVID relief programs. One also does not need to look any further than U.S.'s food assistance program called SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, to see the severity of the problem. The federal government increased SNAP by 12.5% this fall, adjusted to the rate of inflation. In the fiscal year 2021, SNAP served an average of 41.5 million people per month. The U.S. President Joe Biden may boast of a minor drop in inflation.
And yesterday, we got data that showed that manufacturing orders were up, but cost increases in supply chain items were beginning to ease. The week before that, we got data showing that price increase may be beginning to ease as well.
But the fact of the matter is that the U.S. population is suffering from poverty, unemployment, a lack of affordable housing, and lack of access to health care. This is on top of systemic racial inequities. All of these factors have driven food insecurity that affects around 10% of U.S. households. Many people in the UK are also struggling to make ends meet during Christmas time, especially when it comes to food. That is since the UK economy is suffering from negative economic growth that has led many to be food insecure. Driven mainly by soaring energy prices, UK inflation has been running high in 2022, reaching successive new records. In October, households paid 88.9% more on average for electricity, gas, and other fuels than a year ago. So it is natural then that there has been a multifold increase when it comes to people going to food banks. One sobering statistic is that there are now more food banks than McDonald's in the UK. Between April and September, more than 320,000 people in the UK walked into food banks of Trussell Trust, a leading charity fighting against hunger, for the first time, and 1.3 million emergency food parcels were provided across the country. Yet it appears that in the UK, things are a lot worse when it comes to energy bills, especially during the winter time. Families across the UK have to juggle household incomes and make a choice between staying warm or buying food.
So across the UK, we have what we call fuel poverty, which is if you have to spend 10% of your income to afford a decent level of heat and power, you're regarded as being in fuel poverty. September 2021, there are about 4 million households across the UK in fuel poverty.
And that is quite a startling fact, considering how the UK is part of the G7 group of countries. Total wages in the UK have also fallen by 3.9% annually in the quarter to October, accounting for inflation, making the cost of living crisis worse for the average Brit. The natural question is, how did things get down to this, not only for the UK or Europe, but for many other parts of the world, especially during Christmas? Putting COVID aside, the U.S.-backed Ukraine conflict is one major reason, driving up energy prices and hence inflation. Christmas is known to be a time of giving, yet major donations have been going to Ukraine instead of citizens of the donating countries. The Kiel Institute has tracked 93.8 billion euros from 40 countries. Out of that, 52.3 billion euros came from the United States, 29.2 billion euros from the European Union, and 12.3 billion euros from other countries, mostly the United Kingdom.
The salami tactic that Wang Yi is accusing the U.S. of using refers to a practice of using a series of small actions to achieve a much larger end goal that would otherwise be difficult to achieve using one large action. Yi's comments undermine the recent attempts by the leaders of the two biggest economies in the world to reconcile their differences when Joe Biden and Xi Jinping recently met. During Xi Jinping's first in-person meeting with the U.S. president since 2017, the issue of Taiwan was raised. China believes that the U.S. is slowly but surely trying to chip away at China's authority over Taiwan, the incredibly significant industrial island that China deems as its own territory. President Xi calls Taiwan its first red line that the U.S. would be wise not to cross. The intensity of the rhetoric used by both parties to describe the actions of the other party is also escalating. as Joe Biden objected to China's, quote, coercive and increasingly aggressive actions towards Taiwan. Wang Yi told Blinken that the U.S. shouldn't continue, quote, old routine of unilateral bullying. He also said that the U.S. should not be blinded by ideological prejudices and stop putting obstacles to bilateral relations. Prior to his phone call with Antony Blinken, Wang Yi had already met with the U.S. ambassador to China, Nicholas Burns. During that meeting, he noted that the U.S. and China cannot change each other, and the U.S. shouldn't think about thwarting China all the time. This kind of rhetoric is reflective of the frayed relationship between the two superpowers that are a result of U.S. crackdown on Chinese tech companies, human rights issues, and perhaps the most important of all, the issue of Taiwan, and the U.S. constantly undermining the One China policy. The U.S. has recently put major restrictions on some major Chinese tech firms, including Huawei and ZTE, to the point that their products, along with some other brands, can't even be exported to the U.S. The previous bans that were imposed on these companies during Donald Trump's presidency, when anti-China rhetoric began, were a lot less restrictive. On the topic of human rights, just in the wake of April's shooting incident in New York, the U.S. State Department released reports on human rights situation in other countries, including China, with a handful of accusations thrown in the mix. China rebutted Washington's claims against it by pointing out to its failures in upholding the very human rights they have always championed. The issue of Taiwan is a bit more complicated. In the website of U.S. Department of State, you will find the following paragraph on the U.S.'s supposed official position towards China and Taiwan. The United States' approach to Taiwan has remained consistent across decades and administrations. The United States has a long-standing One China policy, which is guided by the Taiwan Relations Act, the three U.S.-China joint communique, and the Six Assurances. We oppose any unilateral changes to the status quo from either side. We do not support Taiwan independence, and we expect cross-strait differences to be resolved by peaceful means. While the document reads that the U.S. does not support Taiwan's independence, a July 2007 Congressional Research Service report confirms that U.S. policy does not, in fact, recognize China's sovereignty over Taiwan. The document further reads, consistent with the Taiwan Relations Act, the United States makes available defense articles and services as necessary to enable Taiwan to maintain a sufficient self-defense capability and maintain our capacity to resist any resort to force or other forms of coercion that would jeopardize security or the social or economic system of Taiwan. The Taiwan Relations Act was passed right around the time the U.S. recognized the People's Republic of China in 1979. Its intent was so that the U.S. can maintain commercial, cultural, and other relations with Taiwan through unofficial relations without government representation and without formal diplomatic ties. China has since viewed the TRA as, quote, an unwarranted intrusion by the United States into the internal affairs of China. As the U.S. continued to supply Taiwan with arms and, more recently, had official meetings with the leader of the island. And this is where Wang Yi's rhetoric towards Blinken starts to make sense. The U.S. has been playing fast and loose with China's sovereignty over Taiwan and the One China policy. China is on a short fuse, and it remains to be seen when their patience will run out.
Special live coverage for the start of New Year 2023 on Saturday, December 31st at 7:30 p.m. Tehran time, 1600 GMT.
School of Soleimani. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As we approach the anniversary of martyrdom of the great anti-terror general and commander of hearts, Qasem Soleimani, we have prepared a five-part series to commemorate this unmatched general. Stay tuned, please. Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said on the personality of Haj Qasem Soleimani, "Let us not look at the dear martyr, Haj Qasem Soleimani, as an individual. Let us look at him as a course, a path, and a school that teaches lessons." Qasem Soleimani was the great commander of the Quds Force of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, IRGC, who was martyred on January 3, 2020, through a drone attack near Baghdad airport by the American terrorist army. Qasem Soleimani was born in Qanat Malik village of Rabur city of Kerman province. He writes in his autobiography, "I was born in 1956. I caught mysalis in a very cold winter. My parents had no hope in my healing. They tested every local medicine, but there was no use in them. According to my father, my mother wrapped me on her back while there was a heavy snow up to the knees and set out for a physician in Rabur. Anyway, after a while, I survived through God's will." Like all villages in Iran, Qanat Malik was very poor during the Pahlavi regime. Therefore, Qasem Soleimani had to leave it for the city at the age of 14. He writes in his autobiography, "My father's debt to the rural bank had made me more concerned than my mother. I cried several times out of the fear of my father's imprisonment. I decided to go to the city to pay my father's debt at any cost. My parents were opposed to me. I was just 14, a weak boy who had only seen Rabur city. His first experience was to work as a worker in a half-constructed building. He continues, "I worked for 6 days from sunrise till near sunset in front of a half-constructed building. My feeble body and young age could not tolerate such a job. My little hands would bleed. His income was low and it would take a long time to pay back his father's debt, so he started working at a hotel. He was working at a fruit juice shop too. Finally, he paid back his father's debt after 5 months." Young Qasem Soleimani was not scared of city anymore. He enrolled at a Zurkhane, a gym where traditional Iranian sport is practiced and taught. He also attended karate classes and got green belt in it. Soleimani writes, "Sport had a great effect on my religious morals and was one of the factors to prevent me from going to immoralities in spite of being young. Bastani sport played a special role in this regard, as it is originated in moral and religious principles." In 1974, he heard a word against the Shah for the first time. While the son of his boss at hotel was speaking of the Shah centers of immorality, one of Qasem's relatives spoke of his oppression and injustice. Martyr Soleimani writes, I noticed that Bahram was speaking like Ali Yazdan Panah, but not of the Shah's corruption, rather of his oppression as people are detained, imprisoned, and killed. The Shah does not allow any gathering be held for Imam Hussein's mourning. As I had grown up with the mourning ceremony of Imam Hussein since my childhood, I said loudly, damn him. As I told this, Bahram was pale and said out of horror, do you want to be detained? 2 years later, Qasem Soleimani started going to a mosque to learn the exegesis of the Quran. This shaped up his religious character little by little. The Shah's regime had set up bars and discos in provincial centers to corrupt youth, but it was not successful in Kerman. In the summer of 1976, there was held a feast by singers and dancers in the city. Young Qasem and two of his friends showed their opposition and anger through puncturing the tires of their cars. Martyr Qasem Soleimani continues in his autobiography, As a teenager, I would fight immorality with honor, and I feared no one. However, I had no clear information on SAVAK, the Shah's intelligence and security apparatus. I had just heard its name several times, but I was not afraid of anything. Elsewhere, Martyr Soleimani writes, It was the Muharram month of 1976. I was looking out of the hotel window. Opposite the hotel was the municipality and police office of Kerman. A young girl was walking on the pavement. A police officer disturbed her. The act was very upsetting for me on the day of Ashura, so I decided to confront him regardless of the consequences. Young Qasem rushed to the street and knocked down the cop with karate moves. The cop hooted his whistle and two other cops ran toward him. Qasem ran to the hotel and hid under a bed. A number of cops looked for him but couldn't find him. On his trip to the holy city of Mashhad, Qasem Soleimani heard the name of Imam Khomeini from two young boys for the first time. As the anti-regime demonstrations escalated in the city of Qom, and also in the city of Tabriz in 1978, the city of Kerman changed totally as well. The chants of death to the Shah could be heard here and there. As a brave youth, Qasem Soleimani would write death to the Shah and greetings to Khomeini on the walls of the city. He writes in his autobiography, I would look at Imam Khomeini's picture several times every day, as if he was by me and I was reading the Quran beside him. He was a part of me. That was the first episode of the 5-part special series on Martyr Soleimani. Tomorrow, we will continue with the second part. The second part will be on his role in the 8-year imposed war.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود
قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is a part of the speech delivered on June 28th, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the head of the judiciary branch and a number of top officials and employees of the judiciary. At one time, the enemy hoped for something. It hoped for a weakness or for a shortcoming in the system of the Islamic Republic, but they were frustrated in this. This has happened many times. However, the problem of the enemy is that they cannot understand the secret behind their being frustrated. They have not been able to understand that in this world, apart from political calculations and contingencies, there are other calculations and contingencies too. One of these laws is Allah will help him who helps his cause. Chapter 22, verse 40. Allah will help him has been emphasized in this verse. Or there is the verse, if you help the cause of Allah, he will help you. Chapter 47, verse 7. This is one of the divine traditions. If the path you are traveling, the work that you are doing, your direction is helping God. Helping God here means helping God's religion and the divine values. If you move in this direction, you will be victorious and God will help you. Of course, the condition is that you must move and take action yourself too. Don't just say something. You must take action. This is a divine tradition. If you are grateful, I will certainly give more to you. This is chapter 14, verse 7.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
If you use a divine blessing in the right place, God will increase that blessing for you. This is a divine tradition. As for those who strive hard for us, we will most certainly guide them in our ways. And Allah is most surely with the doers of good. Chapter 29, verse 69. All of these are divine traditions. In a meeting in this Husayniyah several years ago, I once talked about the story when Moses, prophet, peace be upon him, saved the children of Israel. He led them towards the sea in the middle of night so that they could escape. The next day or the day after, it's not exactly clear in history, Pharaoh realized they had left and followed them. They, the children of Israel, were walking and moving along with difficulty, while these Pharaoh's army had horses and they were riding. When Pharaoh's army approached and could see the people, but when the two parties came in sight of each other, this is chapter 8 of Al-Quran, verse 47. The people of Moses, peace be upon him, turned to him and said, most surely we are being overtaken. Chapter 26, verse 61. The people of Moses, who were cowardly and had little faith, told Moses, peace be upon him, most surely we are being overtaken. They said, they will now come and get us. That's the end of us. Moses, peace be upon him, told them, by no means, surely my Lord is with me. Chapter 26, verse 62. Moses told them that God is with him. This is the divine tradition. All of these are divine traditions.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all. Guiding me from
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
The former U.S. President Donald Trump has released a sarcastic message to his Democratic political rivals on the occasion of Christmas. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Website Politico has covered the story. Former U.S. President Donald Trump has expressed his concerns in a Christmas Eve posting on his Truth Social platform, saying that the United States is dying from within. Donald Trump wrote on his Truth Social platform on Sunday, 25th of December, "On this very cold but beautiful Christmas day, look at our nation now on the southern border compared to only a short time ago during the Trump administration," characterizing current conditions as a horror show. The message followed one from Saturday, 24th of December, in which he expressed his version of goodwill to all, directing tidings to the radical left Marxists and the Department of Injustice and the lamestream media. Donald Trump said the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the FBI, is illegally coercing the media to push for a mentally disabled Democrat who is President Joe Biden. He said in a series of Christmas messages, "Merry Christmas to everyone, including the radical left Marxists that are trying to destroy our country. The Federal Bureau of Investigation that is illegally coercing and paying social and lamestream media to push for a mentally disabled Democrat over the brilliant, clairvoyant, and USA-loving Donald J. Trump. And of course, the Department of Injustice, which appointed a special prosecutor who, together with his wife and family, hates Trump more than any other person on earth." Trump's predecessor, President Barack Obama, and his successor, President Joe Biden, also issued Christmas holiday messages. On Friday, 23rd of December, Trump had responded by video to the release of the 845-page final report of the House Select Committee investigating the 6th of January 2021 Capitol attack. Donald Trump said the American people have been deceived with lies about the 6th of January 2021 attack. The House Select Committee report said the central cause of 6th of January was one man, former President Donald Trump, whom many others followed. None of the events of 6th of January 2021 would have happened without him. The committee report followed criminal referrals to the Department of Justice from the 9-member committee. Trump said the House committee cut the part of his speech at the rally at the Ellipse preceding the unrest out in which he said demonstrators will be walking to the Capitol peacefully and patriotically. Trump has been casting doubt on the outcome of his loss by insisting it was the result of fraud. He said that the 2020 presidential election was the greatest election hoax in history. Donald Trump's claims have significantly delegitimized the democratic process in the United States. A recent opinion poll has found that at least 50% of Republican voters surveyed believe their vote will not be counted accurately the next time they cast a ballot. The Business Insider has also covered the same story and tells us more. In his first Christmas message on Saturday, 24th of December, former US President Donald Trump did not elaborate on why he called himself clairvoyant, which means a person who claims to have a supernatural ability to predict future events. In his next message on Sunday, 25th of December, on Christmas Day, Trump focused on immigration at the southern border with Mexico, claiming that migrants were coming into the country at a rate never seen before. According to U.S. Customs and Border Protection data released on Christmas Eve, a record number of 2.4 million migrants were apprehended along the southern border with Mexico in the fiscal year ending on September 30th this year. Trump wrote, "On this very cold but beautiful Christmas day, look at our nation now on the southern border compared to only a short time ago during the Trump administration." He described the situation as a horror show and said many of the migrants were criminals, including killers, human traffickers, and drug dealers. The number of migrants led to Trump's assessment that the USA is dying from within. Trump, who is running for president for the third time in 2024, won the 2016 election following a successful campaign which included his signature promise to build a wall between US and Mexico to keep migrants out. Donald Trump followed that message with 6 more posts on Christmas Day, including one ending with, "Today, like never before, we're a nation in decline, a failing nation." Trump is currently facing multiple legal troubles, including a criminal investigation into his campaign's effort to overturn election results in Georgia in 2020, and a U.S. Justice Department investigation into the handling of government records. The House 6th of January panel also recently published its final report after a nearly 18-month probe into the attack and asked the Department of Justice to prosecute Donald Trump on 4 charges relating to the riot. Newsweek magazine has also covered the same story. Donald Trump chose to spend Christmas Day posting on Truth Social attacking President Joe Biden, saying, "The radical left Democrats are truly seeking to destroy America," and defend his time as president and his November midterm endorsements. In his first Truth Social post on 25th of December, Trump claimed, "Just 2 years ago, we were energy independent, had almost zero inflation, there was no war with Russia and Ukraine, would never have happened. Daesh was defeated, our military was rebuilt and respected before the disaster of Afghanistan. Our border was strong, the economy was great, the coronavirus was in retreat, and we weren't the laughing stock of the world." Trump was still not finished with his Christmas Day social media post and once again attacked the radical left Democrats in a subsequent Truth Social post, charging them with having weaponized the criminal justice system at a level never seen before in the United States. With no borders and crooked elections, our country is in the third world trouble. Donald Trump's seventh and final Christmas Day social media post saw him continue to push the claim that his former Vice President Mike Pence had the power to reject electoral votes on 6th of January 2021 during his purely ceremonial role as presiding officer of the U.S. Senate. The House recently approved a bill to amend the wording of the Electoral Count Act of 1887 to clarify that a vice president cannot stop the certification of the electoral votes and that their role in certifying the state results is merely ceremonial. Donald Trump wrote, "The vice president did indeed have the power to send electoral votes back to state legislatures for reapproval, despite the constant drum from Democrats that he absolutely did not." Trump added, "But they just put clarifying language in the disgraceful, ominous bill, making sure that a vice president doesn't do what they all said would not be done. So why the new language? Because it was just another political con job."
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Lebanon's economic meltdown is about to enter its fourth year with additional afflictions in its trail. Although the country could finally hold the much-awaited parliamentary elections, it entered the trap of a presidential election stalemate.
With the mindset and the mentality of many of the Lebanese politicians, I think it's a very difficult process. You mentioned the Lebanese forces. It's known the Lebanese forces have this blind hatred and ideological demonization of other parties, first and foremost Hezbollah. This facilitates the intervention of foreign parties like Saudi Arabia, who are said to put a veto on certain presidential candidates.
The year 2022 was not all towards a downfall for Lebanon. The year marked the finalization of a maritime border deal signed by Lebanon and Israel after more than a decade of on-off indirect talks. Hezbollah Secretary General stressed in a brief statement that the deal is a victory for Lebanon's government, people, and resistance. He also declared the end of Hezbollah's exceptional mobilization over the maritime dispute, saying the resistance movement had accomplished its mission regarding the issue.
What happened in Nakara is not normalization with Israel. This deal is not an international treaty and is not a recognition of Israel. Israel itself has admitted it received no security guarantees.
Analysts believe Hezbollah made the right calculations in this move.
What stood out for me was the pragmatism exercised by Hezbollah in this particular agreement. It was very pragmatic in its approach, focusing, I think, first and foremost on Lebanon's economic interests, particularly with the dire economic situation. I think it was also a smart game played by Hezbollah, because I think that they believed deep down there was a conviction by the leadership that Biden couldn't afford another war and would prevent Israel from launching a war, even if Israel had a wish.
The deal is also seen as one of the major achievements of former President Michel Aoun, who stepped down in November without a successor. Now, while Lebanese lawmakers have so far failed to elect a new president, a caretaker cabinet remains in place since the parliamentary vote last spring, showing no sign of efforts to implement economic reforms. As Lebanon ends the year 2022 without a president, observers are skeptical that any achievement concerning this file can be achieved soon. However, many believe that prospects for gas production and export are promising in the new year.
Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Brits are still reeling from the impact of 2022. It's hard to recall a political year that's seen the country lurch from one crisis to the next, all bookended, it seems, by the saga of which particular Conservative Prime Minister was in charge. Boris Johnson had managed to cling on to power despite mounting evidence presented that his position had become untenable. His missteps during lockdown, dubbed Partygate, a faltering economy exacerbated by the outbreak of conflict in Ukraine, made his departure an inevitability. The race to replace him was brutal, exposing the deep divisions within the Conservatives. Party members chose Liz Truss over Sunak before, but that was only the beginning of the saga. Analyst Chris Bambury was following events closely and reflects on that period of chaos.
We had this strange interim where Liz Truss beat Sunak, clearly showing that a majority of the Conservative Party membership were not going to vote for Sunak for reasons which I think are fairly obvious, which are never really talked about. Truss was a disaster. And then we ended up with Sunak being shoehorned into the Prime Ministership with no actual election.
I am resigning as leader of the Conservative Party.
Ah, the blink and you'll miss it Truss era. 7 weeks of chaos which saw the pound take a hit and the markets recoil at the sheer ineptitude on political display. There was a sense that the UK's political landscape had now become a running joke.
The chaos of the Liz Truss premiership, you know, was just awesome. I don't think we've ever seen anything like that in British politics. British politics is supposed to be about stability. It prides itself in selling itself, Britain, as a brand to the rest of the world that has been politically stable. This was like Italian politics, you know, and the prime minister just coming and going. This did not give a vision of Britain as a stable political entity.
Not content with topsy-turvy politics, the UK's longest-serving monarch, Queen Elizabeth II, passed away aged 96, leaving the UK contemplating its colonial legacy. With King Charles III with Camilla, Queen Consort, by his side, it was a new era, but one filled with old uncertainties.
I shall strive to follow the inspiring example I have been set in upholding constitutional government and to seek the peace, harmony and prosperity of the peoples of these islands.
Despite the passing of the baton, the impact of Brexit, the stalemate in the north of Ireland, with the cost of living crisis biting, Prime Minister's in-tray was bulging. 2022 is also the year Britain saw a re-emergence of strike action across a multitude of sectors.
We have been reasonable, but it is impossible to find a negotiated settlement when the dead hand of the government is presiding over and blocking a resolution in these talks.
We are seeing the recovery of industrial unrest, workers taking trade union action, and finding that when they go on strike, they are popular, that people sympathise with them, sections of the working class and indeed the middle class. And I think that spells trouble ahead. These strikes, we haven't seen anything like this in Britain really since the days of Margaret Thatcher. This is new, and I think people are learning new habits, new skills of taking industrial disputes. And I think potentially this is a bit of a game changer down the road.
Rishi Sunak and the rest of his Conservative government will be desperately hoping that there is not a repeat of the past tumultuous year. A 12-month period that's seen record number of Brits slide into poverty. But analysts are warning that desperate changes need to happen because so far it seems the Tories are heavy on excuses and light on solutions. On the cusp of a new year, there are many challenges awaiting the average British family. Whoever is in charge in Downing Street, it's the most vulnerable who continue to pay the